Chapter 5. A longbow and a strongbow, and let the sky grow dark. The cord to the knock, the shaft to the ear, and the king of Koth for a mark. Song of the Bessonian Archers. The mid-afternoon sun glinted on the placid waters of the Tibor, washing the southern bastions of Shamar. The haggard defenders knew that few of them would see the sunrise again. The pavilions of the besiegers dotted the plain. The people of Shamar had not been able successfully to dispute the crossing of the river, outnumbered as they were. Barges, chained together, made a bridge over which the invader poured his hordes. Strabonus had not dared march on into Aquilonia with Shamar unsubdued at his back. He had sent his light riders, his spahis, inland to ravage the country, and had reared up his siege engines in the plain. He had anchored a flotilla of boats, furnished him by Amalrus, in the middle of the stream, over against the river wall. Some of these boats had been sunk by stones from the city's ballistas, which crashed through their decks and ripped out their planking. But the rest held their places, and from their bows and mastheads, protected by mandolets, archers raked the riverward turrets. These were Shemites, born with bows in their hands, not to be matched by Aquilonian archers. On the landward side, mangonels rained boulders and tree trunks among the defenders, shattering through roofs and crushing humans like beetles. Rams pounded incessantly at the stones. Sappers burrowed like moles in the earth, sinking their mines beneath the towers. The moat had been dammed at the upper end, and, emptied of its water, had been filled up with boulders, earth, and dead horses and men. Under the walls the mailed figures swarmed, battering at the gates, rearing up scaling ladders, pushing storming towers thronged with spearmen against the turrets. Hope had been abandoned in the city, where a bare 1,500 men resisted 40,000 warriors. No word had come from the kingdom whose outpost the city was. Conan was dead, so the invaders shouted exultantly. Only the strong walls and the desperate courage of the defenders had kept them so long at bay, and that could not suffice forever. The western wall was a mass of rubbish on which the defenders stumbled in hand-to-hand conflict with the invaders. The other walls were buckling from the mines beneath them, the towers leaning drunkenly. Now the attackers were massing for a storm. The olifant sounded. The steel-clad ranks drew up on the plain. The storming towers, covered with raw bullhides, rumbled forward. The people of Shamar saw the banners of Koth and Ophir flying side by side in the center, and made out, among their gleaming knights, the slim, lethal figure of the golden-mailed Amalrus and the squat, black-armored form of Strabonus. And between them was the shape that made the bravest blanch with horror, a lean vulture figure in a filmy robe. The pikemen moved forward, flowing over the ground like the glinting waves of a river of molten steel. The knights cantered forward, lances lifted, guidons streaming. The warriors on the walls drew a long breath, consigned their souls to Mitra, and gripped their notched and red-stained weapons. Then, without warning, a bugle call cut the din. A drum of hoofs rose above the rumble of the approaching host. North of the plain, across which the army moved, rose ranges of low hills, mounting northward and westward like giant stair-steps. Now down out of these hills, like spume blown before a storm, shot the spahis who had been laying waste the countryside, riding low and spurring hard. And behind them, sun shimmered on moving ranks of steel. They moved into full view, out of the defiles, mailed horsemen, the great lion banner of Aquilonia floating over them. From the electrified watchers on the tower, a great shout rent the skies. In ecstasy, warriors clashed their notched swords on their riven shields, and the people of the town, ragged beggars and rich merchants, harlots in red kirtles and dames in silks and satins, fell to their knees and cried out for joy to Mitra, tears of gratitude streaming down their faces. Strabonus, frantically shouting orders with Arbanus that would wheel round the ponderous lines to meet this unexpected menace, grunted, "We still outnumber them, unless they have hidden reserves in the hills. The men on the battle towers can mask any sorties from the city. These are Poitanians. We might have guessed Tresera would try some such mad gallantry."
Amalrus cried out in unbelief,
"I see Tresero and his captain Prospero, but who rides between them?"
"Ishtar preserve us!" shrieked Strabonus, paling. "It is King Conan!"
"You are mad!"
squalled Sotha, starting convulsively.
"Conan has been in Sotha's belly for days."
He stopped short, glaring wildly at the host which was dropping down, file by file, into the plain.
He could not mistake the giant figure in black gilt-worked armor on the great black stallion riding beneath the billowing silken folds of the great banner. A scream of feline fury burst from Tsotha's lips, flecking his beard with foam. For the first time in his life, Strabonus saw the wizard completely upset, and he shrank from the sight.
"Here is sorcery!"
screamed Tsotha, clawing madly at his beard.
"How could he have escaped and reached his kingdom in time to return with an army so quickly? This is the work of Peleus, curse him! I feel his hand in this. May I be cursed for not killing him when I had the chance!"
The kings gaped at the mention of a man they believed 10 years dead, and panic, emanating from the leaders, shook the host. All recognized the rider on the black stallion. Tsotha felt the superstitious dread of his men, and fury made a hellish mask of his face.
"Strike home!"
he screamed, brandishing his lean arms madly.
"We are still the stronger! Charge and crush these dogs! We shall yet feast in the ruins of Shamar tonight! Oh, Set!"
He lifted his hands and invoked the serpent god to even Strabonus's horror.
"Grant us victory, and I swear I will offer up to thee 500 virgins of Shamar writhing in their blood."
Meanwhile, the opposing host had debouched onto the plain. With the knights came what seemed a second irregular army on tough, swift ponies. These dismounted and formed ranks on foot, stolid Bessonian archers, and keen pikemen from Gunderland, their tawny locks blowing from under their steel caps. It was a motley army Conan had assembled in the wild hours following his return to his capital. He had beaten the frothing mob away from the Pelian soldiers who held the outer walls of Tamar and impressed them into his service. He had sent a swift rider after Trocero to bring him back. With these as a nucleus of an army, he had raced southward, sweeping the countryside for recruits and for mounts. Nobles of Tamar and the surrounding countryside had augmented his forces, and he had levied recruits from every village and castle along his road. Yet it was still but a paltry force he had gathered to dash against the invading hosts, though of the quality of tempered steel. 1,900 armored horsemen followed him, the main bulk of which consisted of the Poitanian knights. The remnants of the mercenaries and professional soldiers in the trains of loyal noblemen made up his infantry, 5,000 archers and 4,000 pikemen. This host now came on in good order, first the archers, then the pikemen, behind them the knights, moving at a walk. Over against them Arbanus ordered his lines, and the allied army moved forward like a shimmering ocean of steel. The watchers on the city walls shook to see that vast host which overshadowed the powers of the rescuers. First marched the Shemitish archers, then the Kothian spearmen, then the mailed knights of Strabonus and Amalrus. Arbanus' intent was obvious, to employ his footmen to sweep away the infantry of Conan and open the way for an overpowering charge of his heavy cavalry. The Shemites opened fire at 500 yards, and arrows flew like hail between the hosts, darkening the sun. The western archers, trained by 1,000 years of merciless warfare with the Pictish savages, came solidly on, closing their ranks as their comrades fell. They were far outnumbered, and the Shemitish bow had the longer range, but in accuracy the Bessonians were equal to their foes, and they balanced sheer skill in archery by the superiority in morale and in excellency of armor. Within good range they loosed, and the Shemites went down by whole ranks. The blue-bearded warriors in their light mail shirts could not endure punishment as could the heavier-armored Bessonians. They broke, throwing away their bows, and their flight disordered the ranks of the Kothian spearmen behind them. Without the support of the archers, these men-at-arms fell by the hundreds before the shafts of the Bessonians, and charging madly into close quarters were met by the spears of the pikemen. No infantry was a match for the wild Gundermen, whose homeland, the northernmost province of Aquilonia, was but a day's ride across the Bessonian marches from the borders of Samaria, and who, born and bred to battle, were the purest blood of all the Hyborian peoples. The Kothian spearmen, dazed by their losses from arrows, were cut to pieces and fell away in disorder. Strabonus roared in fury as he saw his infantry repulsed and shouted for a general charge. Arbanus demurred, pointing out the Bessonians reforming in good order before the Aquilonian knights, who had sat their steeds motionless during the melee. The general advised a temporary retirement to draw the western knights out of the cover of the bows, but Strabonus was mad with rage. He looked at the long, shimmering ranks of his knights, he glared at the handful of mailed figures over against him, and he commanded Arbanus to give the order to charge. The general commended his soul to Ishtar and sounded the golden olifant. With a thunderous roar, the forest of lances dipped and the great host rolled across the plain, gaining momentum as it came. The whole plain shook to the rumbling avalanche of hoofs, and the shimmer of gold and steel dazzled the watchers on the towers of Shamar. The squadrons clave the loose ranks of the spearmen, riding down friend and foe alike, and rushed into the teeth of a blast of arrows from the Bessonians. Across the plain they thundered, grimly riding the storm that scattered their way with gleaming knights like autumn leaves. Another 100 paces and they would ride among the Bessonians and cut them down like corn, but flesh and blood could not endure the rain of death that now ripped and howled among them. Shoulder to shoulder, feet braced wide, stood the archers, drawing shaft to ear and loosing as one man, with deep, short shouts. The whole front rank of the knights melted away, and over the pin-cushioned corpses of horses and riders their comrades stumbled and fell headlong. Arbanus was down, an arrow through his throat, his skull smashed by the hoofs of his dying warhorse, and confusion ran through the disordered host. Strabonus was screaming an order, Amalrus another, and through all ran the superstitious dread that the sight of Conan had awakened. And while the gleaming ranks milled in confusion, the trumpets of Conan sounded, and through the opening ranks of the archers crashed the terrible charge of the Aquilonian knights. The hosts met with a shock like that of an earthquake that shook the tottering towers of Shamar. The disorganized squadrons of the invaders could not withstand the solid steel wedge, bristling with spears, that rushed like a thunderbolt against them. The long lances of the attackers ripped their ranks to pieces, and into the heart of their host rode the knights of Poitain, swinging their terrible two-handed swords. The clash and clangor of steel was as that of a million sledges on as many anvils. The watchers on the walls were stunned and deafened by the thunder as they gripped the battlements and watched the steel maelstrom swirl and eddy, where plumes tossed high among the flashing swords and standards dipped and reeled. Amalrus went down, dying beneath the trampling hoofs, his shoulder bone hewn in twain by Prospero's two-handed sword. The invaders' numbers had engulfed the 1900 knights of Conan, but about this compact wedge which hewed deeper and deeper into the looser formation of their foes, the knights of Koth and Ophir swirled and smote in vain. They could not break the wedge. Archers and pikemen, having disposed of the Kothian infantry, which was strewn in flight across the plain, came to the edges of the fight, loosing their arrows point-blank, rushing in to slash at girths and horses' bellies with their knives, thrusting upwards to spit the riders on their long pikes. At the tip of the steel wedge, Conan roared his heathen battle cry and swung his great sword in glittering arcs that made naught of steel burgonet or mail halberdian. Straight through a thundering waste of foes he rode, and the knights of Koth closed in behind him, cutting him off from his warriors. As a thunderbolt strikes, Conan struck, hurtling through ranks by sheer power and velocity, until he came to Strabonus, livid among his palace troops. Now here the battle hung in the balance, for with his superior numbers Strabonus still had opportunity to pluck victory from the knees of the gods. But he screamed when he saw his arch foe within arm's length at last, and lashed out wildly with his axe. It clanged on Conan's helmet, striking fire, and the Cimmerian reeled and struck back. The 5-foot blade crushed Strabonus' casque and skull, and the king's charger reared, screaming, hurling a limp and sprawling corpse from the saddle. A great cry went up from the host, which faltered and gave back. Trocero and his house troops, hewing desperately, cut their way to Conan's side, and the great banner of Koth went down. Then, behind the dazed and stricken invaders, went up a mighty clamor and the blaze of a huge conflagration. The defenders of Shamar had made a desperate sortie, cut down the men masking the gates, and were ranging among the tents of the besiegers, cutting down camp followers, burning the pavilions, and destroying the siege engines. It was the last straw. The gleaming army melted away in flight, and the furious conquerors cut them down as they ran. The fugitives raced for the river, but the men of the flotilla, harried sorely by the stones and shafts of the revived citizens, cast loose and pulled for the southern shore, leaving their comrades to their fate. Of these, many gained the shore, racing across the barges that served as a bridge, until the men of Shamar cut these adrift and severed them from the shore. Then the fight became a slaughter. Driven into the river to drown in their armor or hacked down along the bank, the invaders perished by the thousands. No quarter they had promised, no quarter they got. From the foot of the low hills to the shores of the Tibor, the plain was littered with corpses, and the river whose tide ran red floated thick with the dead. Of the 1,900 knights who had ridden south with Conan, scarcely 500 lived to boast of their scars, and the slaughter among the archers and pikemen was ghastly. But the great and shining host of Strabonus and Amalrus was hacked out of existence, and those that fled were less than those who died. While the slaughter yet went on along the river, the final act of a grim drama was being played out in the meadowland beyond. Among those who had crossed the barge bridge before it was destroyed was Tsotha, riding like the wind on a gaunt, weird-looking steed whose stride no natural horse could match. Ruthlessly riding down friend and foe, he gained the southern bank, and then a glance backward showed him a grim figure on a great black stallion in pursuit. The lashings had already been cut, and the barges were drifting apart, but Conan came recklessly on, leaping his steed from boat to boat as a man might leap from one cake of floating ice to another. Tsotha screamed a curse, but the great stallion took the last leap with a straining groan and gained the southern bank. Then the wizard fled away into the empty meadowland, and on his trail came the king, riding hard, swinging his great sword that spattered the trail with crimson drops. On they fled, the hunted and the hunter, and not a foot could the black stallion gain, though he strained every nerve and thew. Through a sunset land of dim and elusive shadows they fled, till sight and sound of the slaughter died out behind them. Then in the sky appeared a dot that grew into a huge eagle as it approached. Swooping down from the sky, it dove at the head of Tsotha's steed, which screamed and reared, throwing its rider. Old Tsotha rose and faced his pursuer, his eyes those of a maddened serpent, his face an inhuman mask. In each hand he held something that shimmered, and Conan knew he held death there. The king dismounted and strode toward his foe, his armor clanking, his great sword gripped high.
"Again we meet, wizard," he grinned savagely.
"Keep off!" screamed Tsotha, like a blood-mad jackal. "I'll blast the flesh from your bones. You cannot conquer me. If you hack me in pieces, the bits of flesh and bone will reunite and haunt you to your doom. I see the hand of Peleus in this, but I defy you both. I am Tsotha, son of..."
Conan rushed, sword gleaming, eyes slits of wariness. Tsotha's right hand came back and forward, and the king ducked quickly. Something passed by his helmeted head and exploded behind him, searing the very sands with a flash of hellish fire. Before Tsotha could toss the globe in his left hand, Conan's sword sheared through his lean neck. The wizard's head shot from his shoulders on an arching fount of blood, and the robed figure staggered and crumpled drunkenly. Yet the mad black eyes glared up at Conan with no dimming of their feral light. The lips writhed awfully, and the hands groped as if searching for the severed head. Then, with a swift rush of wings, something swooped from the sky, the eagle which had attacked Tsotha's horse. In its mighty talons, it snatched up the dripping head and soared skyward. And Conan stood struck dumb, for from the eagle's throat boomed human laughter in the voice of Peleus, the sorcerer. Then a hideous thing came to pass, for the headless body reared up from the sand and staggered away in awful flight on stiffening legs. Hands blindly outstretched toward the dot, speeding away and dwindling in the dusky sky. Conan stood like one turned to stone, watching until the swift, reeling figure faded in the dusk that purpled the meadows.
"Crom!"
His mighty shoulders twitched.
"A murrain on these wizardly feuds. Peleus has dealt well with me, but I care not if I see him no more. Give me a clean sword and a clean foe to flesh it in. Damnation! What I would not give for a flagon of wine!